From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there are five tropical systems, including multiple hurricanes, brewing in the oceans around the U.S. right now. Two in the Pacific, two in the Atlantic, and one in the Gulf of Mexico. Let's bring in Carl Parker, a hurricane expert for the Weather Channel. He's with us from Atlanta via Skype. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, and let's start in the Pacific and the first storm that is expected to get very close to or hit Hawaii. Tell us about Madeline.
Well, Madeline is a very strong storm right now, and it's on its way towards Hawaii. And what's really unique about that is that Hawaii, the big island of Hawaii, has actually never been hit in the record. And that's because the water is typically too cold to support stronger hurricanes. So usually if Hawaii is hit by hurricanes, they come up from the south from where there is warmer water. But the water temperatures have been abnormally warm east of Hawaii. And so you've got this storm and then another one following that, and that is Lester. And both of them could have an impact on the Big Island. We do think that the second storm, Lester, is most likely going to travel to the north of the Big Island.
Why is the water so much warmer in the Pacific this year?
There are a couple of things. You've still got the residual effects of El Nino, which is an abnormal warming of the equatorial waters of the central and eastern Pacific. And so even though we've seen a La Nina trying to develop and waters have been cooling, it's still quite warm in that part of the world. But in general, the oceans all over the world are warming. We see nothing but positive anomalies in the eastern Pacific, through much of the Pacific, and much of the Atlantic as well.
And when you say positive anomalies, you mean that the water is getting warmer, not that these are good things for the globe.
Exactly right. You know, the oceans are taking on most of the warming that's occurring on the planet. When that occurs, you're going to increase the chances that you'll get more tropical storms. Now, it takes a lot of things to make tropical cyclones. A lot of things have to come together perfectly. But all other things being equal, if you've got more heat in the oceans, you have more potential for stronger tropical systems.
All right, well, let's talk about the tropical systems that are in the Atlantic. There are, and if you include the Gulf of Mexico, there are currently three of them right now, including Hurricane Gaston, which does not look like it's going to have much of an effect on the U.S. Is that right?
Yeah, Gaston is actually well out over the open water of the Atlantic. And a thing that typically happens with storms, if they develop early as they come off of Africa, there are these African easterly waves that will move off to the west. And if they develop early, they tend to feel stronger upper level winds and get curved up into the North Atlantic. And so it's actually the weaker systems that pose more of a threat because they drive with the low level flow, the easterly trade winds in the southern part of the Atlantic, and they'll make it all the way across. And then if they get into an environment that is more favorable for development, then they can pose more of a threat. And that's exactly what's happening with this Tropical Depression 9 right now. It was a very weak wave through most of its lifetime and then got into the Gulf of Mexico and now is finally beginning to develop.
And what do you expect it will do?
Most of the guidance right now is suggesting that it's going to be a strong tropical storm. Now, a strong tropical storm is not very far away from being a hurricane. So if, for example, you've got a 70 mile per hour tropical storm, that's hardly any different than a hurricane. However, we don't think that it's as likely that it's going to be a hurricane. It's probably going to bring a lot of very heavy rain to Florida. There will be a tornado threat because of some stronger winds aloft. We'll see gusty winds, tropical storm force winds, and there could be a modest water level rise as well, and that's an area that's very surge vulnerable. Now, what's interesting is what might happen after that, because the storm has gotten farther west. It's going to be moving in farther west along the coast of Florida, the northwest coast of Florida, which means that there's more of a chance that it will run along the coast and up through the Carolinas. And then in the long term, it might actually have an effect on the Northeast.
When would that be?
The models are differing on that point. You know, one of our more reliable models wants to bring it up somewhere in the vicinity of Monday. Another one wants to make it a little bit later than that, more towards the middle to latter part of the week, actually takes it out and then brings it back into the Northeast. And, you know, this is the type of thing that we saw with Hurricane Sandy, which is not at all to suggest that we're looking at a Hurricane Sandy here, but rather just talking about the upper level pattern. We've seen these anomalously warm and strong ridges of high pressure at very high latitudes. And where a lot of hurricanes might run up along the coast and then zip out into the North Atlantic, when you've got one of these ridges parked over the eastern part of Canada, it acts as a blocker, just like a blocker in football, prevents the storm from moving out, and then because of the clockwise flow around the south side of that ridge, then drives the storm west. And that's what we saw with Hurricane Sandy. And so there is some chance that we could see something like this with this storm. There's a chance that it could become a stronger storm as it comes up through the Carolinas, maybe a hurricane. And there's a chance that it could be driven west and back towards the northeast coast.
Believe it or not, there is another storm that we haven't talked about yet. That's Tropical Depression 8, which is off of North Carolina. Is that any threat?
Not really. It's a rather weak system and, had a brush with the eastern part of North Carolina and now is going to be pretty rapidly moving out and towards the northeast. And it's not going to have any effect on any landmass at that point.
That's Carl Parker, who's a hurricane expert for the Weather Channel. Carl, thanks so much as always.
Absolutely. Thank you.
ISIS is confirming that its spokesman and the chief strategist for the group's attacks against the West has been killed. ISIS says Abu Muhammad al-Adnani was killed while overseeing operations in northern Syria. The Pentagon said the U.S. conducted airstrikes targeting Adnani, but didn't confirm or claim Adnani's death. Well, today Russia did. The defense ministry in Moscow said it was a Russian airstrike that killed him. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. He joins us from Washington. And Phil, before we get to who might have done this, tell us more about Abu Muhammad al-Adnani and who he was.
Abu Muhammad al-Adnani was one of the top leaders in the Islamic State, or ISIS. Our reporter, Dina Temple-Raston, has done a lot of good reporting on this group, and what she has described is his role in encouraging so-called lone wolf attacks in the West. He helped coordinate the movement of the foreign fighters who've traveled to Syria to join ISIS and generally was considered an important figure in the terror group.
By the way, why would ISIS, given that he was such an important figure, why would they announce that he's died? I'm asking you to speculate here, but you'd think they wouldn't want possible recruits to know they've been wounded.
There's some discussion about whether or not he might have been being groomed for another promotion, if you will, if the group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, might have become incapacitated or taken off the battlefield in some other way. And also these semi-official news agencies that are connected with these terror groups generally are forthright about identifying their own leaders after they've been killed. And so this is just kind of a common practice that they've gotten into.
Yeah, maybe they think that that might be a recruiting tool, you know, somebody who's been martyred, but that's, again, speculation. How much of a blow do we know this will be for ISIS?
The Pentagon described it in its words, quote, as a significant blow. The Pentagon spokesman, Peter Cook, described him as the principal architect of ISIL's external operations and its chief spokesman, which is the way he's been described in a lot of the reporting. And so if you imagine the COO of a company or somebody of that magnitude no longer being able to participate in its operations, the Western officials who are prosecuting this campaign hope it will be very disruptive for ISIL's operations generally and its terror operations in the West specifically.
Yeah, especially since he was the voice who, as you say, called for lone wolf attacks. What do you make of the claim by Russia that it was Russian airstrikes that killed him?
It's a very bizarre claim, and no one in Washington at this time appears to know what to make of that. We know that Russian forces are very active in Syria. Obviously, Russia is supporting the regime of Syrian President Bashar Assad against anti-government forces and, in some cases, ISIS in the midsection and north of Syria. It's possible that Russian airstrikes may have taken place near the city of Aleppo yesterday, and it's possible that they may have happened before or after this airstrike. But the Pentagon was very clear in its statement that it conducted a precision strike. It used an unmanned aerial vehicle, a drone, and that it was targeting al-Adnani. It won't say that definitively he was killed, but a lot of the indications are that, in fact, they're confident that he was. So the Russians seem to be throwing a monkey wrench in this situation, as they have so many other times over the course of the saga in Syria.
Mm. Well, Phil, where are we with the state of ISIS? We're hearing that ISIS is being diminished, even though we're seeing these lone wolf attacks. What's the sense, especially with this strike, this successful strike, what's the sense of the strength of ISIS?
As of now, there is no ground force strong enough to defeat ISIS in Iraq or Syria. The U.S. is helping indigenous forces in both places to try to do that. But it expects there to be a long, bloody campaign still to come to try and attack these two twin ISIS capitals of Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. And if that gets underway in the fall and takes weeks or months in the case of Mosul, that'll be a best-case scenario for the U.S. and Iraq. American officials in Washington have been very careful to manage expectations about how this is going to go. Even if those two cities are captured, they say, that might not put an end to the terror threat that ISIS poses to the West. It could continue to run networks in Europe and the United States, possibly, and launch these attacks that we've seen over the past several months, even after it suffers even more on the battlefields in Iraq and Syria.
Phil Ewing, NPR's national security editor, on the silencing of a top ISIS voice, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, Donald Trump makes his first foreign trip as the Republican presidential nominee to Mexico, a country he said sends rapists and criminals over the border. Trump is taking up an invitation from Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, who has a 23% approval rating at home and who has likened Trump to Hitler. At least two anti-Trump demonstrations are being held in Mexico City today. And later tonight in Arizona, Trump will give a much-anticipated speech on immigration. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton makes her first public appearance in days with a speech to the American Legion National Convention in Cincinnati as she continues to struggle with questions about her private emails and Clinton Foundation donors. Joining us now, a regular political analyst, Angela Rye, Democratic consultant. She's with us by Skype. Hi, Angela.
Thank you.
And Paris Denard is also with us. He is a Republican consultant. Paris, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Jeremy. Glad to be here.
Okay. Paris, what do you think of this trip to Mexico?
I mean, I think this is a good thing. I think this is a presidential move that Mr. Trump is doing. He is meeting with the president who invited both Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton to meet with him. And as I understand it, Secretary Clinton did not accept the invitation, and Mr. Trump is going down there before his speech. This is what leaders do, and this is what presidents do. They meet with people even when they have disagreements, and they're going to come together and hash out some of the differences that they may have. But I do believe that they have a lot of similarities because of the economic problems that are going on in our country are similar to the problems that are going on in Mexico.
Angela, what do you think about this trip?
So a couple of things. I think it's important to note that Hillary Clinton did not decline the invitation. She has not agreed to go yet.
And I think that's it.
Absolutely. I think she's demonstrated during her career as the Secretary of State that she would go anywhere to meet with anyone to ensure that our diplomatic relations are strong. I think that her rhetoric has matched that record. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case for Donald Trump. So this is a big risk for him. But if it goes well, it's a tremendous reward. And it does give him the opportunity to shore up some of the voters that he lost during the primary season who are brown people. There is, of course, a hashtag coming out of Mexico today that's hashtag Trump not welcome. So we'll see how he's able to reverse course there.
Do you think, Paris, that there are risks to the visit? Because we remember back when Mitt Romney went to London during the 2012 campaign and they came out with the hashtag or the headline Mitt the Twit after that visit.
Look, there's a risk in everything that you do in politics, but with no risk, no reward. Mr. Trump is an excellent negotiator, and he's a lifelong businessman who has dealt with leaders of foreign countries and businessmen all across this country. So this is nothing that is out of the ordinary for him. So I believe that what he's doing is demonstrating that he is capable of being presidential. It's a good thing for the country, and it's a good thing for Mexico that the two leaders are coming together, because if there is going to be a Trump administration, they will have to work together.
And Angela, as you look at the bigger issue here of the immigration policy, do you think that Trump is changing his position on immigration and on illegal immigration? And should the Clinton campaign be worried if he is?
Anyone with two ears knows that Donald Trump has changed at least the way that he's discussing immigration policy. I don't know that there was ever a clear policy. Donald Trump talked about having Mexico build a wall since the very beginning of his campaign. Donald Trump talks about Mexicans being drug dealers and rapists, and that is how he rolled out the campaign. That is a founding principle of his campaign. I think the distinction here now is he says that he wants to deal with the immigration problem in a more humane way. well, if 11 million people still need to be deported and he doesn't support, you know, the president's executive actions on DACA or DAPA, then it's still not a humane way. The campaign has continued to talk about getting rid of or deporting criminals. Are you talking about those who already spent time in jail? Well, if that's the case, you know, I think even that is interesting. And what does the process look like? I think the final thing is their campaign continues to talk about ICE and in allowing them to do their job. Well, that is also new because before they said that ICE was failing us and the Obama administration was failing us. If they're allowing ICE to do their job, then that is exactly what Barack Obama did and same thing under George W. Bush.
All right. I want to switch gears here because let's talk about emails, which is just a story that has gone on and on and on. And now the State Department says it's analyzing 30 emails that were not forwarded to the FBI for its investigation. It says could be about the Benghazi attack. Angela, how long is this going to go on? And is this harming Clinton in the polls that it's just every day there's another story about either pay for play in the Clinton Foundation or the emails? It's kind of one long thread that just keeps coming.
I think, yes, Jeremy. I mean, any campaign would not want this level of distraction. I think that there have been valid questions raised, asked and answered. I think that Hillary Clinton has demonstrated over time her willingness to apologize for it. I also think that she's made some missteps in dealing with the email issue. I think that this needs to be taken seriously and they have to correct it and try to move on. I think the challenge is every time they try to pivot, there is another story. I don't know, you know, why that continues to happen. I know, for example, there was an AP piece that was put out last week, you know, scathing about the Clinton Foundation. And the problem was they didn't analyze a full universe of emails. And I think that the Clinton campaign and other news sources did a great job of beating back that report. But I think we have to wait to see what happens with the emails the State Department is analyzing. I think they said by the end of September.
You know, Jeremy, look, it continues to reinforce this theme of somebody that can't be trusted, somebody that's not being honest and shooting straight with you, and somebody who the rules don't apply to them. The American people and a lot of millennials don't like that, and it's not going to sit well, and it has the potential to really hurt her in the polls.
Angela, on the issue of the Clinton Foundation, why don't the Clintons just say, we're going to shut it down if she becomes president? We'd rather be in the White House again than have the foundation and be in the White House?
So, Jeremy, a couple of things. With all due respect, I think a number of people who continue to raise the question have never run a large enterprise. And I think it's clear because even when you're talking about her becoming the president of the United States, their transition teams are in place. Donald Trump's transition team is in place. That's her true. Transition team is in place. And the reason for that is because it takes time to change something over. Right now, you have a Clinton Foundation that services a lot of people globally. If they were to shut down today, number one, you have several people at the Clinton Foundation who are out of jobs. You have contractors who are out of work. You have young people and elderly and, you know, people from all over the world that no longer get services with no warning. That is a major blow to people who don't have anything to do with any email, whether it came from the State Department, the Clinton Foundation, a personal assistant, or anywhere else. Human beings who are benefiting from their services should not suffer. I also don't think that Clinton Foundation employees who are doing good work, doing God's work, should be punished for that. I really don't. I think that they should have time to transition and wind things down and allow the Clintons to get out of that work and not necessarily stop the good work of the foundation.
You buy that, Paris?
No, not really. Look,
that's too bad because it's the truth. I don't lie for candidates.
No, and I'm not lying. Nobody denies that the Clinton Foundation does good work. But what is apparent is that some of the people that are engaged with the Clinton Foundation did some things that are not appropriate as relates to Secretary Clinton and her role. Donations, favors, and things of that nature are inappropriate. And so we have to look at, can she be fair? Can she be honest? And can she be trusted to be president of the United States and run a foundation that has a history of doing things while she was in office that if it happened to anybody else or any other nonprofit or any other billion-dollar organization like Trump has run, they would be shut down? It's a legitimate question.
I want to ask you both about one more thing, which is the polls, which if you look at the Real Clear Politics average of polls in the battleground states, Hillary Clinton is ahead in almost every single one, although her bounce after the convention has certainly come down significantly, and she's ahead in some places just by a tiny bit. But Angela, what do you think when you see the polls? Do you feel confident about the election, or are you a little worried?
No, I'm absolutely worried. I think that, you know, this election is something that changes day by day. Arguably, Jeremy, second by second. And so I think they need to pay close attention, not only to the polls, but making sure that they're talking and constantly engaging with targeted constituencies. I think that the Clinton campaign throughout has done a good job of doing that. They've shored up their bases. You know, she did have an advantage here because Bill Clinton, when he was even going out, had a very, very high approval rating. She did very good work as Secretary of State and had a high approval rating there. But she has to constantly work through this. I think that she will probably experience a bounce after the first debate. Hillary Clinton is a formidable debater, and we saw that in 2008 when she got Barack Obama pretty good. So I think this is something that they're going to have to pay close attention to. But luckily, things are still going in her favor.
Paris, what do you think about the polls?
I think Angela Rye is 100% accurate when she says that the candidates need to continue to address and campaign targeted communities. And I think that's what you've seen Mr. Trump do as it relates to the African-American community. And the Economist YouGov poll is proof positive that shows him at 8%, which is above what Mitt Romney received in 2012 at 6% and above what Senator McCain received in 2008 at 2%. And so the more that he continues to chip away at her core demographic and constituency bases, the more he makes inroads and the more he talks directly to these specific communities, I think he is going to do well. And I think every single day this campaign gets more and more important for us because we can see that the election is going to be tight. It's not going to be a blowout. This election is going to be very, very tight. Every vote is going to matter. Every constituency group is going to matter. And everything they say and do is going to be essential. That's why this trip to Mexico is important for Mr. Trump. That's why his debate performance is very important to Mr. Trump. And that's why I believe his engagement, specific engagement with African-American and Latino communities is going to be critical.
That's Paris Denard, a Republican strategist and Here Now political analyst, and Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, Here Now political analyst. Thanks to both of you, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
The rest of the country is becoming aware of what residents of a housing project in East Chicago, Indiana, have known for about a month. Their public housing project will be demolished. They have to move, and soon, because of lead in the soil outside their homes from a nearby decommissioned smelter. 29 people, including kids, have already tested for elevated levels of lead. Families want out, but it's not that easy. Community volunteer Juan Fernandez is a former resident of the West Calumet Housing Project, who's hoping to provide a little help. He's here by Skype. And Juan, you're trying to get people to donate moving supplies?
Yes, me and a couple of my friends decided what's the best ways that we can help the community right now. And when you're moving, you need boxes, scissors, tape. And what we thought, you know, if the community could come together and help give this to the residents and, you know, just show that we're, you know, even if it's a small giving, it's still something that, you know, the community try to help out with.
Right. But meanwhile, there are big problems as well. As you know, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development has given the East Chicago Housing Authority about almost $2 million to help residents pay for new rentals in the city or move anywhere in the country. But it's still unclear whether they're moving expenses or security deposits. And people are quoted in the reporting today saying, I don't have that kind of money, you know, to put down first last month's security. So people are very concerned. So you're trying to allay that a little bit with at least maybe some moving expenses. Tell us about living in the projects. When did you live there?
I lived there from 95 to 99. We moved out. And, you know, it wasn't so much like a very bad, when people say a bad projects and nothing like that. It was fixed income, low income housing. My dad got laid off. So my family, we had to move there. And, you know, some people's rent range from anywhere between $500 to $10.
Well, and we're seeing pictures there, these really actually kind of nice brick, not high rises at all, maybe a couple stories high, and a lot of dirt area. And you're seeing a lot of young children. Were children playing in the dirt when you lived there?
Yeah, we used to play football in the backyard, cook out in the backyard. There was a baseball field maybe 4 blocks from my house. So, you know, it's a pretty tight-knit community.
Yeah. Well, the New York Times quotes the acting head of the regional EPA there in the Indiana area saying there have been public notices about the soil for a decade. But it's only been since May that they saw these alarming test results, and that's why the mayor took action a month ago and said, everybody out, we're demolishing it. But did you ever hear about lead in the dirt or see notices?
You know, I didn't see that. So if someone knew about that then, I knew definitely my dad would not have allowed his family to move into a contaminated area.
Well, meanwhile, we understand you have friends there, one who has 5 kids. Tell me what they're going through.
You know, she's a single mother, so it's more or less, you know, she's on her own. So, you know, they're telling people they have to move, but some of these people really don't have the resources to help them move. You hear stories like this, and it's devastating.
So you're hoping that even just to help a little bit with tape and scissors and things, but we're struck by the fact that this was a month ago where the mayor said, you know, everybody out, and it's just now becoming a national story. Are you surprised?
You know what? I am definitely surprised. We've been trying to contact different media and, you know, just to bring the attention to it for we could get more people to help out, because it's going to take more than the elected officials and organizers. It's going to take a lot of people to help this situation.
Community volunteer Juan Fernandez, a former resident of the West Calumet housing project there in East Chicago, who's trying to help the people now having to move because of lead poisoning in their soil. Juan, thank you. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Would you pay almost twice as much for a restaurant meal as someone else might pay in another part of town for the same meal at the same brand restaurant? Twice as much? Maybe not. Well, how about if you knew that if you and others didn't pay double, say around $8 to their four-ish, that other person might not be able to afford the meal at all and the fresh food in it? That's the thinking behind Every Table in Los Angeles. The founders hope to start a chain of twinned restaurants, one in a well-off neighborhood, one in an inner-city food desert, with the same exact menus, same decor, but different price plans to bring healthier food to everyone. Sam Polk and David Foster are the co-founders of Every Table. Sam, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And David Foster, you're there?
I'm here.
They join us from the studios of NPR West to talk about it. Sam, start with you, because we understand that this thinking jumps off a company that you founded called Grocery Ships. What is Grocery Ships, and then how does this restaurant grow out of that?
Yeah, so in 2013, I founded a nonprofit called Grocery Ships, which works at the intersection of poverty and food-related health issues like obesity and diabetes. You know, the place where Grocery Ships exists is South Los Angeles, where per capita income is $13,000 a year, and basically helps parents that are living in food deserts, places where there's very little fresh food and tons of fast food. And it helps parents get healthy through a program that includes nutrition education, healthy cooking skills, fresh produce, and emotional support groups. And we kept hearing from a lot of the parents that we were working with things like, you know, I need to get food on the go and I don't have a lot of money, so I go to McDonald's. I'm a former hedge fund trader and David's a former private equity guy. And we basically sort of took out our pencils and started trying to figure out a concept for a business that would make healthy food that would be affordable for the families in the neighborhoods that Grocery Ships was serving.
Well, it's so fascinating that you applied your Wall Street skills. So, David, pick up with Every Table. You've got one location downtown Los Angeles, one that you've opened in South L.A. What's the difference?
Yeah, so the first location is in South L.A. It's on Hoover and 23rd Street. We offer meals for, on average, under $4. We've got a variety of items like cold salads, kale Caesar salad, a great California Cobb salad, as well as some warm items like a Puebla chicken tinga and a Jamaican jerk chicken and some kids' meals as well that actually sell for $2.95. And really the model for that store is to try and be priced affordably for the local community down there and also to be priced competitively with what else is out there. So in South LA, the prepared food options really look like fast food, so the McDonald's and Taco Bell's of the world. The second location is going to be opening up downtown, which is about a mile and a half or 2 miles from the first one, but the demographics are quite different up there. It's more of a working professional crowd. So that location is going to be offering the same meals, but for about $7.95 on average. And we think that's priced really competitively with what's in downtown. So Whole Foods and Sweet Green and Tender Greens and great healthy, fast casual options like that typically cost about $10 to $12. So we think that even though it's twice the price, only a couple of miles away, it's still offering really great relative value for a product that people are excited about.
Right. So what's the relationship between the two restaurants, one charging double? I mean, it sounds like the downtown one will subsidize the one in the neighborhood that couldn't afford those prices.
Yeah, so each store is really designed to be individually profitable. So at $4 per meal in South LA, we're not making much money on each meal that's sold, but if we get enough people to come out and we're already seeing great traction, it on its own 2 feet will actually be profitable. And the location downtown will also be profitable. So together, they're really part of this company that's working to improve access.
Right.
And the higher income one or higher price one is really going to be funding the growth to open new locations in both markets.
And Sam Polk, I want you just to jump in with some of the other thinking about how you're going to make this work. You'll have one central kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, this central kitchen producing a large amount of healthy food, and we have two chefs. One was the former head chef of Le Cirque, one of the greatest restaurants in the country. The other was the head chef of a Culver City restaurant called A-Frame that was super hot and super local. And they're creating these meals like the Jamaican jerk chicken and the blackened fish that are literally mind-blowing. And then at the commissary, packaging them in grab-and-go containers. And that's the, you know, really simple but key economic insight, which is that, you know, a standard restaurant, you walk in, it's 2,500 square feet of space, has 10 to 15 employees, a fully built out kitchen. And for all those reasons or all those additional costs, that's why they can't sell healthy food at a low price. But for us, we open stores that are 500 to 750 square feet, and we don't need a commercial kitchen because all the food is grab and go already in containers. And because of that, we only need two employees in the stores. And so all those savings are then passed on to customers who have these delicious, healthy meals that you can get faster than you could when walking into a fast food place, for example.
Well, but how much a part of your marketing is going to be your concept? I mean, I would think that you're hoping that people come to, especially the higher priced one, because they know they're part of this circle of food.
I think people are going to be thrilled about it before they even understand the social mission. And when they understand the social mission, I honestly think they're going to become deeply loyal customers.
That's Sam Polk. David Foster, let me ask you, didn't you need a little bit of help doing this? I mean, has your company itself been subsidized? I know you worked closely with Tom's, the Tom's Shoemakers. They have the Social Entrepreneurship Fund. Could you do this without that kind of backing?
We definitely couldn't do this without the support of a lot of people, both friends and family and former colleagues, investors in the angel investing community, some of the great social enterprise VC firms like Blake's Social Entrepreneurship Fund over at Tom's, as well as Lair Hippo, which is a great New York-based firm. So from a capital standpoint, we've definitely been really fortunate to partner up with some groups and individuals who see the same vision that we do and want to be a part of this change. And the work that we're actually doing is not the two of us. It's 20, 30 of us.
It's a restaurant as sort of social experiment, kind of a tiny bit of nonprofit thrown in. I mean, it's not your traditional business model. I'm wondering, I spent some time in South Central after the riots with a little boy who, you know, was surveying this just apocalyptic scene. Everything in his neighborhood was destroyed. He was 10. His name was Noah. And I'll never forget, he said, he saw the Taco Bell was destroyed. And he said, Taco Bell, we can't live without our Taco Bell. And it was kind of cute and funny, but it wasn't funny because what he meant was that was his idea of food. That was it. That was his source of food. How do you change that attitude when Popeyes and Taco Bell is seen as the source of food?
Yeah, this is Sam speaking. We actually think there's something of a misconception around this issue out there, which is that people in South LA have access to fast food right now largely because it's the only affordable solution. So we know from our work with grocery ships and now with the really incredible sales that we've seen in the first month of Every Table that there is high demand for healthy, nutritious food within the South Central community. You know, what people think of as healthy food was actually just what people called food 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean there's long history cultural traditions of incredible cuisines that have existed for centuries. And so what we're doing is we're bringing those back. We're going to the communities that we're trying to serve and saying, what are the meals in your culinary tradition that you love but you don't see offered for a good price in a convenient manner right now? And then we're creating those meals and selling them at a really attractive price.
And by the way, we should rush to say that, of course, there are, you know, small pockets of great little joints all over South LA where people are making meals, but not enough right now to compete with the fast food. That's Sam Polk. He and David Foster are co-founders of Every Table, with one location so far in South LA and another one that's going to be opening downtown, and they will sort of be symbiotic, as we've just heard. Sam, David, thanks, and best of luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So there are others trying to come up with ways to share the cost of food. Every Table has the shared prices, the shared kitchen. Panera Bread has Panera Cares, about five locations where people pay what they can. And Panera's been able to generate enough money from people who pay above the menu price to cover both their operating costs and the meals of people who can't pay the full menu price. So your thoughts on sharing the costs of restaurant meals? Let us hear them at hereandnow.org.
For a lot of people, especially college students, tomorrow or someday this week is move-in day, which often means renting a truck or packing up your car. But when we were in Portland, Oregon earlier this year, we discovered that in the city of bicycles, some people move by bike.
We got a tarp.
I don't know if it'll work.
On a rainy day on the campus at Reed College in Portland, so Ken Sutherland and Nate Martin are loading a queen-size mattress onto a metal trailer hooked to the back of a bicycle.
Wait, so you're going to try to put this on that?
I've done it before, so let's see if it works. Yeah.
And I won't even tell him that it did fall into the mud a little tiny bit when it was being put.
That was me. That was me.
Martin is moving off campus, but he didn't want to get a moving truck. Instead, he's decided to move by bike.
You get a bunch of people together. They bring trailers. You put out a call about a month or so ahead of time. Tell them kind of what you have, what the biggest challenges are. At the beginning, you offer snacks and coffee. At the end, you offer food and maybe beer. We're going to have tacos and beer later.
And why did you decide to do it this way?
When I first moved to Portland, somebody that I was seeing at the time showed me a website and said, look, move by bike. I'm like, what? What is that? And I had just gotten a bicycle for the first time in like 10 years. And I'm like, that sounds amazing, but I can't imagine how I could do that.
We got a tarp.
I don't know if it'll work.
On a rainy day on the campus at Reed College in Portland, so Ken Sutherland and Nate Martin are loading a queen-size mattress onto a metal trailer hooked to the back of a bicycle.
Wait, so you're going to try to put this on that?
I've done it before, so let's see if it works. Yeah.
And I won't even tell him that it did fall into the mud a little tiny bit when it was being put.
That was me. That was me.
Martin is moving off campus, but he didn't want to get a moving truck. Instead, he's decided to move by bike.
You get a bunch of people together. They bring trailers. You put out a call about a month or so ahead of time. Tell them kind of what you have, what the biggest challenges are. At the beginning, you offer snacks and coffee. At the end, you offer food and maybe beer. We're going to have tacos and beer later.
And why did you decide to do it this way?
When I first moved to Portland, somebody that I was seeing at the time showed me a website and said, look, move by bike. I'm like, what? What is that? And I had just gotten a bicycle for the first time in like 10 years. And I'm like, that sounds amazing, but I can't imagine how I could do that. And then about a year or two later, I met a bunch of people who actually did do those things. And these are actually the people that are here today.
When you say that sounds amazing, why did you think that sounded amazing?
Yeah, it just sounded, it sounded kind of stupid. I'm like, can you really do that? And I've always liked the idea of like relying less on motor vehicles, less on gas, less on fuel. And I just wanted to know how that could be possible. And I mean, I've seen people move refrigerators, couches.
By bike?
By bike.
Are you worried at all about your stuff? About it getting damaged on this bike ride?
Yeah, a little bit about the water. I've got a few boxes with books. I'm going to try to point those out as we go. But people generally, like, there are some tarps. I've got a lot of garbage bags. I think we can make it work.
Is it harder to do it when it's raining like this?
Yes. I wish it weren't raining, but I'm that much prouder of everyone who showed up. Hey, Ken.
Hey, Caroline.
Caroline Zabitkowski has a white bike with a covered compartment attached to the front where she usually puts her son. Today, she's filled it with boxes, and in the safety of a trafficless sidewalk, I decided to take it for a spin.
Okay, so...
So I just go. I just start going.
So, yeah, you push it forward. There you go.
Almost fell over twice. Okay. That's why I don't do bike moves.
Maybe it just takes practice. Something Steph Routh has a lot of. This is her 79th bike move. What's the hardest part about it?
That's a good question. I think riding in it, if it's your first time, just testing it out after you've loaded it up. Because sometimes, you know, you think that you've packed something down and something falls off the back.
Well, I'm just imagining the person who's tasked with, you know, bringing all the wine glasses, and all of a sudden they go down a big hill, and the next thing you know, psh.
Yeah, those are definitely, the ones that are fragile, are labeled fragile, are definitely the ones that are put up high. We've also had, you know, cats and dogs and chinchillas that have been moved, and those definitely go in a very special place by a veteran bike mover.
Now, I have to say, this is probably one of the most Portland things I've ever heard of.
Although, actually, I know I was asking, I think in Cleveland, New York, I know Eugene, there's a number of places in Europe. This actually, it sounds like it's a lot of Portland, but actually it's many cities around the country and the world.
Have you made a lot of friends through this?
Yes. Actually, I think most of my closest friends have been bike moving. And I think it's partly you're helping someone move, which is a horrible, very stressful thing that no one likes to do. And so if you're willing to show up to someone's bike move, it means that you're family.
Here we go.
After less than an hour of loading up about a dozen bike trailers, the group sets off, listening to music for inspiration, as they pedal 9 miles on a carefully planned route through the rainy streets of Portland. At one point, the tarp on the mattress starts to rub the ground.
Somebody want to help me?
The group pulls to the side of the road and quickly adjusts the mattress.
Count to three. We're all going to try and pull it towards me. One, two, three.
Does someone need to hold the trailer?
And they're off again. After a little more than an hour of riding, the team starts unloading, and it's time for their payment.
The first batch of the corn tortillas, little crispy.
It's taco and beer time, and Nate Martin can now relax in his new home.
This is amazing. The unpacking, I don't know. It'll happen tomorrow. Tomorrow in the next few days. I've got the rest of the week off. But yeah, mainly we're just going to like throw all the stuff in my room and just hang out and eat and drink beer. Ain't gonna count.